But I heard on, from Dino and from Jack that he does a real nice job. And we were kind of wondering if he was going to make it tonight, and somebody come running in there with a big book under their arm, running like a windmill salesman or a full of brush man, and I figured that must be him. And so, but he comes from a primary purpose group over in Dallas, and I've heard a lot. I met some people from there, and I've heard a lot of good things about that group, and I don't want to take any more time. So, John, if you'll come up here, let's give my East Side welcome.
I'm not going to sit on it. I'd be way too nervous for that. I'm going to move it to the other side, though. For some reason, it feels better on this side than that side. My name is John Kelly. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September the 4th, 1999, and for that, I am very, very grateful. And I just saw my sainted mother today, and she's pretty grateful, too. She likes that. I sure put that woman through a lot of misery over the years. Some might call me fanatical. I don't know. Some call me a big book dumper. But that's the way I was brought up. I'm not going to tell my story tonight. I'm going to get right into the steps. But I got sober in September of 1999, and that wasn't my first go-round in this rodeo. I started trying to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in July of 1988. And I've been to literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of meetings all over the state of Texas, all over this great country and the Caribbean. Got piles and piles of desire chips. And in the last 5, 6, 7 years of my drinking, I did not want to drink anymore. Did not. I didn't want to go to jail anymore. I didn't want to lose any more friends, lose any more jobs, lose any more freedom, lose any more of my dignity. And I had no iota what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. See, I'm one of these cats that's pretty hip, slick, and cool. You get me sober for a few days, and I can hear what these people say in these meetings and stuff, and I can mimic, and I can copy, and I can come up with my stuff on my own, and you'll be patting me on the behind after that meeting, and I tell you, I'm doing great. And I always got drunk. I have no success doing it any other way, so we just go right by the book. And we are big book thumpers where I come from. So I'm going to just kind of do it like I do when I do these treatment centers. But, you know, I've had an Alcoholics Anonymous book since 1988, and I never read the darn thing. I'd read some stuff, and some would make some sense. Some of the stuff wouldn't make any sense. And it didn't ever really sink in. I didn't really identify with much. I remember the first time I read Bill's story in 1988, and I'm thinking, man, that guy really needs to be sober, you know. I had no concept of what he was talking about because I hadn't done any of that stuff yet, you know. And I'm sure a lot more happened to Bill in Bill's life than what's in his story. But, you know, when I got sober in 99, my story made his look like a walk in the park, you know. I mean, it was a tedious process to get me to see what was in this book. And I thank God every day that I made it to a group where the people in that group, the lights are on, you know. I won't mention the group, but my last home group before this group, I mean, I got so many desire chips there, I mean, they didn't even clap anymore when I get one. And they didn't have anything to offer me either. And you know, I was convinced that I was just going to die drunk. And that's what I tried to do in the summer of 99, because I couldn't stay sober. I'd been in 5 emergency rooms in about a 10-week period, all alcohol-related. And I was just resigned to the fact that I was going to drink myself to death. And that's what I tried to do that entire summer. Drink enough vodka, not the good stuff, Skol. Pop that little governor out of the top, you know, so you can drink it fast. And somehow on Labor Day weekend for that Friday, I came to and blood all over me, and I hadn't been stabbed, you know. And I had one thought that crowded out all else is, I don't want to die this way. And I detoxed myself not too far from here at my brother's house, and I made it to primary purpose on that Tuesday of September 99. And the first person I saw was this little old man who I'd met the year previous, about 80 years old, I was shaking and vibrating and stunk to holy hell. And that old man walked up to me and gave me a hug. And I looked at him and I said, I need to talk to you. And he looked back, you know, over the top of his glasses like your grandpa would do when he means business. And he says, what the hell can I do for you? And I said, I'm scared. And I don't want to drink anymore. And he said, come on. And we sat down in this little room before the meeting started. And this little old man opened up his big book. And he must have done a marvelous job 12-stepping me. Because it sunk in. So we're gonna do it the way the old man does it. And it was passed on to him like this. And this is the way we're going to roll. But if you have a big book, you open it up to the title page and it tells you right what this book is about right off the bat. It says Alcoholics Anonymous is a story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. I can't tell you how many treatment centers I've been in that tells me I'm always going to be a recovering alcoholic. And when I think of that, I'm thinking of some sniveling, whining, I'm always in recovering. That offers me no hope. That offers me no hope. They're telling me I'm going to recover from alcoholism. This is a book on how they did it. So let's see what the book says. If you turn past the table of contents to the preface in the second paragraph, it says, this book has become the basic text for our society. This is a textbook. What do you do with a textbook? We study it, right? When we got to first grade in math class, the little math teacher passed out math books to everybody. Unless you were a friggin' genius, you didn't go to the end of the book start working big problems, did you? No, we had a teacher who was there to guide each one of us students through the work so that we could learn the principles of mathematics. This is a textbook. I'm going to refer back to it over and over. It's all marked up, notes in the margin, pages falling apart. I'm going to study it. Why on earth, you ask, do I study the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? If you flip the page, it tells you right there, forward to the first edition. This is how we open up our meetings. We don't read how it works. That's granted, we're granted that right in the fourth tradition. But it says, and as it was written in 1939, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered. There's that word again. Hadn't even got to the real number pages yet, and they mentioned recovered twice. And it says, we've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. A hopeless state of mind. Here's my definition. Back in the day when I was drinking, in order for me to get through the day, I had to drink no matter what, and it was killing me. In order for me to live, I had to drink, but it was killing me. That sounds like a conundrum. I don't know. I couldn't live with the booze, and I sure as heck couldn't live without the booze. But I had to drink. A hopeless state of mind and body. Now, here's another great line. It's probably one of my favorite lines. It says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we recovered is the purpose of this book. So they're telling me that the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous is giving you and me precise instructions on how to recover from the deadliest illness known to mankind, alcoholism. Alcoholism kills people that ain't even alcoholics. Precise. What does precise mean? It means exact. No gray area. The big book, the textbook, tells us how to take the steps, when to take the steps, with whom to take the steps. There's prayers and promises all along the way. Promises of what happens when you follow the directions in the big book, and there's some promises that'll come true if you don't follow directions in the big book. And I have experienced all those promises at one time or another, you know? But precise. Telling me to put the plug in the jug and keep coming back, that sounds good. They don't mean me any harm by it. But if I could not drink and go to meetings, I'd be out there not drinking and going to meetings. I have no successful experience in that. I'm a chronic, end-of-the-line, street-level alcoholic of the hopeless variety. Me sitting around a meeting and hearing about your divorce one more time is not... is not a program of action for me. It says, for them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. This is the only book where we have instructions on the steps. There's lots of great books put out by Alcoholics Anonymous. I have them all. I encourage you to get them all and read them all. They're awesome. The 12 and 12 is an awesome book. There's no instructions in the 12 and 12. It's written by a guy who was 20 years sober at the time. That's like me showing up September the 4th, 1999, and my sponsor that night, instead of 12-stepping me, he told me what his life was like today. Great! How in the heck do you get there from where I'm at? That's why we have this book. And if that rubs you the wrong way, read page 17 of the 12 and 12. It'll tell you that this book is where the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is. It says, we think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. So we're going to have chapters called Doctor's Opinion. They're going to explain this illness. We've got chapter to the wives, to the family afterward, to employers. Why? To let those folks out there know what's killing us. See, their solution for us drinking is totally different than what our solution is. You know, they get hurt, they stop. I get hurt. Oh, it wasn't that bad. I keep going, you know. And it says, and besides, we're sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. So obviously, we get sober, our lives improve. Our families' lives improve. We're better employees. We're better taxpayers, yada, yada, yada. But since these 12 steps were adopted, there's over like 280 other groups that use the same darn 12 steps. Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous. You name it, Anonymous. There's one called Messies Anonymous for people that, I guess, are too messy or not messy. I don't know. They'd have a relapse if they came to my house, that's for sure. The basic thought on that is the 12 steps work when applied to whatever is killing you out there, right? The next part of the book is forward to the second edition. Written in 1955, it tells about how AA grew, how it was started, how it grew. Grew real slow in the first. It's all word of mouth. Bill met Dr. Bob. They got Bill Dotson. Slow, slow, slow. Until some articles were written, Jack Alexander in particular, and AA blew up. Right? And it grew incrementally year after year after year after year. Until a little bit later on. And we'll get to that in just a second. The part I want to work out, talk about here is, I know, I'm doing the steps, but I got to get ramped up before, I'm getting there, okay? But if you look in the fourth to the second edition on Roman numeral 20, five lines down from the top, they give you some statistics. Now, these aren't empirical statistics. They didn't talk to every single member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but the home office contacted the groups that were in existence at the time and asked them some general questions about their membership. This is what they generally found to be true. It says, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. All right? So back in the day, early AA, half got sober, stayed sober. It's pretty darn good. Real good. There's not a treatment center on this planet that can sniff 50%. It says, out of 25% of those returned as time passed, right? So they had 25% of that other 50%, they had to go do some more drinking. Knuckleheads like me, you know. Weren't willing to get a sponsor, weren't willing to help anybody, weren't willing to make amends, whatever the case may be. Weren't convinced of step one, whatever. They went out and did some more drinking. 25% of them made it back. It says out of the remainder of those, 2 out of 3 returned as time passed. There's groups in existence still today with documentation from way back in the early days that were knocking out 75%, 85%. All right? AA, in the year 2000, estimated less than 5% of the folks coming into Alcoholics Anonymous are going to achieve 5 years of sobriety. I don't know about you, but that sucks. Well, how could you go from at least 50% to less than 5% in a matter of 50 years? How can that happen? I mean, alcohol is alcohol, right? Booze is 100 proof is 100 proof. Rotten, nagging spouses are still rotten, nagging spouses. Crappy jobs are crappy jobs. Problems are problems. Well, what changed? Well, I'm going to lay out how it worked back in the day and see if this matches up to your little experience today. Back in the day, we got this guy here. We'll use a guy. We've got this guy here. He's in the hospital detoxing one more time. His family has thrown more money at his disease than... I mean, he's been on the Dr. Phil show. He's been to the best treatment centers. And this guy's in the hospital detoxing, dying one more time. Back in early AA, the guys would come visit this cat in the hospital. And we sit down with this cat. And we tell him our stories. We identify him. We find out all we can about this young man. And then we leave. And then we come back the next day and we sit down with this young man again and we go through that same old spiel one more time. Find out a little bit more about him. We identify with him. We tell him our story. We tell him what it was like when we were trying to stop drinking and drinking. And then we leave. And we do this for a couple, 3 or 4 days. This guy's getting a little more clear-headed while he's in the hospital. We come back to visit him and he knows one thing. I drank as much booze or more than he ever dreamed of drinking. And he's dying and I ain't. And he says, you're just like me. How do you stay sober? Now I got him. Now I get to lay out this program, the spiritual program of action. I become that man's sponsor. We go through the steps as outlined in this book. This man recovers and now he is helping this man. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, folks. Not once did I say it was sitting around a table talking about our days, the IRS, any of that stuff. I mean, if your doctor diagnosed you with cancer, you wouldn't go to a meeting talk about cancer for 90 days, would you? Nope. I don't think so. So let's find out what it means to be a real alcoholic, because if we don't understand step one, all the rest aren't going to make a difference. We're going to go to the doctor's opinion. This doctor's opinion was written by William D. Silkworth. Worked at Towns Hospital in New York City, a little hospital right off Central Park in New York. Worked with over 50,000 of us alcoholics and drug addicts during his tenure at Towns Hospital. All right? He was an expert on us. He loved us. But he couldn't figure out, why is it that guy or that gal that comes to his hospital that's drinking to excess, maybe they're going through a divorce, or maybe they're going through a period of their life where they're just drinking way too much and they end up in his hospital, and they counsel them, they nurse them back to health, they give them some hydrotherapy, I guess that means we're really clean when we leave there, I don't know what that means, they shoot water at us, I don't know. But they do all they can, and this person's scared to death that they're going to lose the rest of their family or their standing in society or whatever the case may be, and this person leaves the hospital never to return, right? They learn their lesson. And then you got guys like me, go to the same hospital, get the same treatment, knowing full well when I leave there, I cannot so much as take one drink of alcohol, or I'm going to lose my job, my house, my car, my kids, my freedom, my dignity, knowing all that. And I leave that hospital in high hopes. In a short amount of time, I'm right back to drinking. Man's been trying to answer that riddle since booze was invented. Hell, they've been preying on us, moving us from here to there, giving us hobbies. They tried everything. Finally, they just come up with a solution. They just lock us up for it, you know? So this doctor came up with a theory. And when this book came out, it was just that, a theory. If you can ever get a hold of a first edition, you'll notice he don't even sign his name in the first edition. All right? It's just anonymous doctor, I think. Or I've seen it, but I don't remember what it says. Since then, science has proven his theory to be 100% accurate. Step one says we admitted we are powerless over alcohol. Now a completely different thought, a hyphen, that our lives have become unmanageable. All right? So let's see what the doctor says. He says, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. Right? So he's saying if you're a real alcoholic, a chronic alcoholic, your body reacts differently to booze than 90% of the world's population. They estimate about 1 in 10 of us have what it takes to be an alcoholic, right? An allergy. An allergy is just an abnormal reaction to something you eat or drink. Who's allergic to penicillin in here? Always. Susanna, what's up? What happens when you have... Right? And I've heard, I asked that to a lady a couple days ago, and she says, I die. And I was like, what? She went straight past the hives and throwing up and throat constricting to die, you know. She just had a flair for the dramatic. See, isn't that odd? If I get an infection or something like that, I can go to my doctor, he gives me penicillin, and it cures me. It fixes me. Susanna can get this very same infection and go to her doctor, and they give her penicillin, and she swells up, you know, throat constricts, has a hard time breathing, and maybe if they gave her enough penicillin, she would die. Right? She has the allergic reaction, right? That's just the way she is. That's the way I am. Doesn't matter. He's saying if you're an alcoholic, you have an allergic reaction to alcohol, right? And he says that his is how the allergic... I don't break out into like hives and I've broken into some stuff on alcohol, but I hadn't broken out anything. But this is what I got. Dino in the back. I like making him laugh, you know. This is what the allergy does in a real alcoholic. He says that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in those other people. The phenomenon of craving. It's one of the things that sets me apart from those normal drinkers or those hard drinkers. See, I get the thought in my head, I'm going to take a drink, and I take the drink and I trigger this out. Is there anything that she can do other than getting an antihistamine or something, or you know, whatever they do to counteract? If she takes penicillin, once she takes it, she's going to have the reaction, right? There's nothing she can do except go to the doctor and get the antidote or whatever, right? I take a drink of alcohol, I trigger this allergy, bam, my brain says, let's have another. And another, and another. And it was just my intention. You know, it's Friday night, I just got paid, my boss's birthday, and everybody's going to a little pool hall to sing happy birthday to my boss, right? And I call my girlfriend, and she says, hey, I'm making your special dinner, and I have the Wonder Woman costume all lined up, right? It'll be ready at 8 o'clock, you know? And I'm like, it's my boss's birthday, I'll be home by 8, right? And it's my intentions. I love the Wonder Woman costume, you know? It's my intentions, but I get to this place, everybody's having a good time, and I take that first drink, and bam, I trigger that allergy. Now my brain says I'll have another, and another. Now I'm doing shots. Now I'm at a bar where the girls don't have any clothes on. Now I'm here, now I'm there. Who knows when I make it home, right? The phenomenon of craving. See, it happens to alcoholics. It don't happen to those other people. I mean, did you ever get to a point where you said, no, I'm too drunk tonight? I didn't utter those words. I drank till I passed out, and I drank as soon as I came to. That's how I do this thing, right? I'm powerless. I've lost control. Once I start, I cannot control how much I drink, right? That makes sense. It's my job in the beginning when I sit down with a newcomer to lay this out. And it ain't my job to pat him on the behind and tell him I'm going to love him into sobriety. My job is to paint the picture. And I'm going to paint the picture as dark as I can. Why? Because that's my experience. I drink, I can't control how much I drink. If this was my only problem, because I know there's been many, many times where I woke up after one of those bad nights and I thought, this has got to stop. I've drank too much again. I've just got to stop because I think alcohol's the problem. Well, if this was the problem, what would be my solution? Don't drink. Makes perfect sense to a normal person. Oh, you drink too much, so don't drink. Well, that doesn't work out for me. Why? Because of the second half of step one. My life is unmanageable. Why is that? Because my mind always leads me back to the drink. Always. It always leads me back to the drink. I'll read the rest of this paragraph here. It says, these allergic types can... And the reason I read this, because I remember one, like my first or second treatment center, and I still have the big book, because I have in mind here, you know, powerless and all this stuff, you know, all my little notes and everything. But on this one particular big book that I got this treatment center, this part that I'm going to read to you, they told me that's why my life is unmanageable, right? And so I'm going to read what they say. It says, these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Once having formed the habit, found they can't break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them, they become astonishingly difficult to solve. And I'm just listening to what they said, and they said, that's why your life's unmanageable. It made perfect sense to me. Right? No, that's not the right answer. Those are consequences. Hell, you drink from the time you get up to the time you pass out, life becomes increasingly difficult to handle. Problems pile up. Those are consequences. Has nothing to do with why my life's unmanageable. Second half of step one, the reason my life is unmanageable, to save my life, to keep that job, to keep my freedom, to keep my girlfriend, to keep my kids, I am unable to manage the decision to stay away from the drink. Cannot do it on my own power. I've tried it over and over and over. That is why my life has become unmanageable. Has nothing to do with those consequences. Nothing. The circumstances of my life don't make me an alcoholic. Down at the bottom of that page, they say men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. It's a pretty true statement. And let's make it a real true statement. Alcoholic men and women drink essentially because we love the effect produced by alcohol. I mean, come on. Don't tell me you just drank just for the taste. I've drank some nasty stuff in my day, including rubbing alcohol. Hey, if you're stuck out in the country and you ain't got no wheels and all they got is rubbing alcohol and you need a drink, you'll drink it. Or I did, at least. I don't recommend that to anyone. I hear you can go blind or whatever. I don't know. I was in Iceland. You should see the stuff they drink. Oof. Anyway, I want the effect. I mean, I went through life before I ever took a drink. I didn't know this until, you know, now that I'm sober and all this stuff, looking back, reflecting upon my life. But I needed a drink long before I had a drink. I needed a drink. My girlfriend had it right. She drank when she was 8. You know, she held out as long as she could, man. She needed a drink when she was 8, you know. I held out till I was 15, right? But see, you know, I'm the first kid. There's 2 sets of twins behind me. I'm the first grandkid. Granddad was pretty well off in West Texas. I had the best shoes, the best clothes. My family loved me. There's no alcohol in my direct family. I had everything looking for, you know, the future looked bright. I played every sport. I was great at every sport. I made great grades. You know what I'm saying? Everybody pat me on the butt, telling me how great I'm going to be when I grow up. You know, and I dreamed that I was going to go to UT and be a lawyer like my uncle and work at his law firm. I'd be retired by now, you know. Except I had this little voice in my head. You're telling me I'm great, but I had the little voice in my head going, "You're a friggin' loser." You know what I'm saying? I was like, we moved around a lot. I was self-conscious. I was real shy. I'd meet some friends, and then we'd move, right? But I had that little voice in my head. You know, I'd walk into this room, and I'd think, you're all staring at me. What did I do? I just didn't fit. The twins below me, they bond. And, you know, I don't fit. Until I was 15 at tennis camp in Florida, and I took my first drink. And then I fit. All the dots were connected. The keys to the universe were in my possession. Those chicks that I was with, they wanted me. You know what I'm saying? I was hip, slick, and cool, you know? I want that effect. I want that effect. Right? It says this sensation is so elusive. See, I had that effect for years and years and years until the tables turned, and I couldn't quite keep that effect. Oh, I just drink right on past it. It was fleeting, you know what I'm saying? I don't know if it was the third drink or the fifth martini or whatever, but I'd get that effect, but I've already triggered and I'm gone. I overshoot the effect over and over. The sensation is elusive. You know, it's like trying to catch a greased up balloon or a pig or something. It's just elusive. I can't just get to that sense of ease and comfort and stop. Why? Because I got this allergy telling me to drink another and another and another. It says that while they admit it is injurious, oh, I got some injuries. Now, the injuries don't make me an alcoholic, but I got plenty of injuries. Oh, I've been to jails. Only 2 times. I've been to jail twice. I mean, it's not like I'm a hardened veteran, you know, of jail. I can't stand up here and say, oh, I could do jail time standing on my head, you know. That's nothing. I've wrecked cars. Most of the wrecks that I've had in cars were not my cars. They were your cars, you know. I was always driving them. Been to 5 treatment centers. I don't know how many hospitals. I don't know how many friends I've lost, how many great jobs I've lost, family members I've lost. How about dignity? Ooh, I lost some dignity too. Alcohol took me to places I never dreamed I'd go. Took me with people I never dreamed. Hell, I'd go home with Bo Derek, wake up with Bo Diddley. You know? I've used that joke for like 6 years now, and it always gets a laugh. But yeah, I had some injuries. I mean, that's the truth. I leave this building today, and I go have a drink. That stuff starts to happen, and in a hurry. I mean, a little bit before I got sober, I left one day before I'd ever had a drink. Had a little, like 2 months of sobriety, and I left this little halfway house. All I was going to do was look for an apartment. And I ended up in jail with a felony possession, PI, and kicking a cop in the chest who was trying to pull me out of a cab. I mean, that's where my drinking took me to. right? That's the truth about my drinking. But what does my brain tell me? It's not that bad. Just a little bad luck. I had bad luck for the 90s, you know? It was all bad. Everything was bad. I mean, I had a psychiatrist when I was like 19 years old was telling me, you know, list all the bad things in your life. And even at 19, all the bad things that I considered bad in my life were all a direct result of the alcohol. I drank 17 more years, you know. It was a tedious process. It says to them, well, I'm going to hold my finger on that page. And I'm going to go to, see, I'm going to give you the bad news of step one. You go over here to, there's a solution, page 24. It's in italics. This is the bad news of step one. It says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. They're saying if you're a real alcoholic, you ain't got no choice in the matter. You're gonna. It's not a matter of if you're gonna drink; it's when you're gonna drink. It says our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. Now, here's the tricky part. This is the part I like to ram home all the time in little treatments, and just because this is the part that I never understood. It says we're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Welcome to your life being unmanageable. They're saying that the day that I take my last drink, within a certain amount of time, and it varies. For me, my life unravels quickly when I'm not drinking. So the time frame is very, very short. But they're saying the day I take that last drink, I get removed from that last drink. My little brain is unable to come up with a solution to not drink. I can't remember it. Well, let's do a little test. Close your eyes and think of the worst, most painful, degrading experience you had as a direct result of drinking. So what were you doing 24, 48 hours later? Oh, drinking. Isn't that amazing? Amazing. First time I got thrown in jail. God, I prayed all day long. And I'd been kind of 12-stepped a little bit, and I kind of knew a little bit more than I had done in previous times. And I'm praying all day long in loose there. God, if you'll get me out of this, I'll do anything. I'll call Frank back. I'll get the best lawyer I can get, and I'll get out of this, and I'll go back to my meetings. And, you know, and I'm just praying all day long. And I'm in bad shape, bad, bad shape, shaking it out. And I mean, it's horrible. My little boss at the time bonded me out that day. I got thrown in jail on Sunday night sometime. I bonded out Monday evening. And I'm walking out loose there, and I'm putting my watch on my wrist, and my watch says 8:47. And I ran across the street and bought me another bottle of vodka. You think that I walked into the liquor store and put that vodka up there and said, hey, I just got the hell kicked out of me and I got a felony possession, a PI kicking a cop in the chest. Give me another bottle of this stuff, man. No, but I had to drink. I drank no matter what. See, left to my own devices, I'm unable to manage the decision to stay away from booze. I've lost the power to choose. Those are the only two questions you need to answer in your little heart of hearts for step one. I know they've got little pamphlets that say 20 questions or 40 questions. Hey, if you answer those two questions, you're going to answer all the rest of those other questions. I think. I don't know. I've answered them all. Hell, drink in the morning, drink at night. Yeah, I mean, you name it. Lost jobs. I mean, come up with 100 questions. They're all going to be checked. True, true, true. It doesn't matter. I've lost the power to control it. I've lost the power to choose. Welcome to step one. But let's look what Bill says more about step one. Go over to page 30, and I love the way he writes. This is why we do a big book study all the time in my group. Why? So we can learn what's in here. Look what he says. He says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. See, when I was in college, I'd be proud to tell you I was an alcoholic. Why? Because it was fun. I drank better than most people. I didn't get sloppy back then. I didn't slur my words. I could drive better, dance better. You name it, man. It was good. I was proud of it. But towards the end, now I'm hiding booze, and I lived alone. Go figure. I don't know. Don't know what I was thinking. We cleaned up my apartment when I sobered up. There was, you know, y'all been through it. There was booze everywhere. I didn't want to admit that I was a real alcoholic. See, I went through like most of the 90s trying to still prove that you were the reason why I was an alcoholic. That's why I moved to Puerto Rico. Drunker than you know what. I just had to get away from Dallas. Tried to blame it on my family for a while. Trying to wish upon, I mean, I'm not making light of this, but wishing that I was like, you know, abused as a kid. That must be why. I must have been abused as a kid. That's why I'm an alcoholic, you know. I didn't want to admit I was a real alcoholic. It says no person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Bodily different from the allergy. Mentally different because I have a mind that leads me to the drink. See, my mental obsession is subtle. They call it cunning, baffling, powerful. See, I go to the little meeting, get a desire chip, and make a go at AA, and they tell me to keep coming back. They tell me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I do that. And because I'm an alcoholic, I think, well, I'll do that, and I'll even join the sober softball team, you know? And I'll get some Tony Robbins books, and I'll start running 5 miles a day, doing push-ups, doing good deeds for my mama, you know? You see me at a meeting, I tell you, you ask me how I'm doing, I tell you I'm doing great. Doing great. Feel better. Sleep better. Everything is great. God is wonderful. Right? But inside, it ain't that great, because I'm like an actor. See, little by slowly, I'm unraveling on the inside. And maybe somebody in my group tells me, man, maybe you just need to double up on your meeting. Okay. Maybe you just need to make out a gratitude list. Oh, okay. And the days go by, and I unravel a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And I don't like feeling that way. Start feeling a little self-pity. Start feeling some fear. Start feeling that feeling of uselessness. Why me? You know? But you ask me how I'm doing, I tell you I'm doing good. See, I feel that way long enough, that spiritual malady. I feel that way long enough. I don't like feeling that way. My little mind says, I don't know why the world treats you so poorly. You're a good guy. You look a little stressed, John Kelly. Stress is very, very dangerous. I'm here to help you. I love you. It'll be different this time. What you and I need to do is we need to go on down to Centennial and just get us a little pint of vodka. I know you're an Alcoholics Anonymous. This is just between me and you. No one will know. That's the mental obsession. And that is a death sentence for an alcoholic. Because the mental obsession condemns an alcoholic left to his own devices to drink to the bitter end. It tells me when I work with others to stress the hopelessness of the situation, so I hope I'm doing a good job. It says, therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. I bet there's some provers in this room. Trying to prove, hoping against all hope, that the previous 1,000 experiences of my drinking. Tonight, I'm going to be a miracle of control. Tonight, I'm just going to have a couple, enjoy the evening, and call it a night. I'm going to prove. Maybe I'm not going to drink tequila. I'm a vodka and Rumpelmans type of person. You know, the higher the proof, the better for me. You know? So I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to drink beer. I swell up, you know. To prove that, now here we go. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. See, my brain tells me that I can control and enjoy it. Now, I don't know about you. If I ever tried to control it, I sure as heck wasn't enjoying it. Anybody ever try to control your drinks for you? I went to a party with a girl one time, and it was like a cash bar at this party. And so I gave her my money, right? And so she was buying the drinks. And she was, because we'd had some run-ins, you know. So she's buying the drinks, right? After the first couple of drinks, I'm trying to figure out a way that I can kill her so I can get my money back, you know. Because I was not having a good time. And we ended up having to leave that place. I can't control and enjoy it. And if I'm enjoying it, I sure as heck ain't controlling it. Right? But my mind, think about it. Think not this time. I know you're all big book thumpers in here and everybody's rocking and rolling. But think back to one of those other times when you swore you're never going to do it again. Right? You were given sufficient reason. Right? Maybe it was a job. Maybe it was the relationship. Maybe it was just you looking in the mirror and you swore you were never ever going to do it again. Right? And maybe you went to church more. Maybe you did more good deeds. Maybe you went to AA. Right? But you didn't drink. My question is how free were you? Because if you were like me, I wasn't even drinking. But you know what? I was thinking about not drinking. I ain't even drinking back then, and booze still owns me. Hell, they're telling me to stay away from my playmates, playthings. Oh. The mental obsession is a killer. So they call it an obsession. And look at this next one. The persistence of this illusion. What's the illusion? That I can control and enjoy it. That I can drink like a gentleman. That I can drink like a normal person. That is an illusion. Well, what's an illusion? If I turn this book into a parakeet, did I really do it or did I trick you? That's what an illusionist does. He makes us see things that aren't there. My illusion back in the day was that somehow I'll be able to drink normally. I have no experience, although I have no experience drinking normally. Never done that. Got drunk the first time out and damn near every time thereafter. But my illusion is that I can drink normally. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. I don't know about y'all when I started drinking, but going insane from it or dying from it, we're not on the horizon. But that's where alcoholism took me too. You know? That's just the ugly truth. And it says, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step. I got to concede in my heart of hearts. Right? No lurking notion. In my group, we call it the Holy Trinity. I know there's a real Holy Trinity, so I don't mean to be blasphemous, but we'll just call it the Trinity, the Alcoholics Trinity, right? The job, the car, and the girl. If I can just get the job, the car, and the girl, my life will be okay. See, I was under that illusion a long time too, that if I can get these external circumstances in my life situated, I wouldn't drink. That's not a step one. If you can get sober that way, more power to you. My hat's off to you. I cannot do that. I have no experience doing that. I just had a talk with a treatment center in Dallas the other day. And that's what they're telling these guys. You don't need to work the steps right now. You need to get your job situation squared away and get this stuff. You know? That's pretty scary, folks. You know, I'm thankful that we get to go carry the message there, but good God, that's a real uphill battle. Because I'm telling them the exact opposite. The big book is telling them the exact opposite. You know, I got to know in my heart of hearts that I am, A, in fact, an alcoholic. You know, I got to know here. I knew up here for a long time. But see, I could never admit that I was a real alcoholic because I didn't know what a real alcoholic was. You know, I finally, thank God I started going to jail, started having some more car wrecks, and started ending up in hospitals. I've gone through DT twice. You know, I've had some seizures, you know. So in some people's eyes, you're an alcoholic, right? I still was drinking. I mean, Bill puts it real good in his story. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I was overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And that was like all. That's how I felt. 1998, 1999. I had no other option except to drink. You know, drink for the end. Drink for the end. Because I was convinced, because of what I was told, what I thought I knew about this program, I was convinced that I didn't have a shot. I was convinced. I remember the day. I don't know what day it was because these days were, I kind of blackout among blackout. But I remember this one little conversation I had with my boss, and I had quit this job. It's kind of towards the tail end of summer of 99. Because I'd called, this guy was a kind of irrational. He got kind of pissed off at me because I called in sick on Monday and then Tuesday, and I was calling in sick on Wednesday, and it's like the 50th time I've done that. So he got a little upset with me. It's kind of unreasonable. But anyway, so I fired myself and started drinking real heavily, you know, just to try to die. And I just remember thinking to myself, you know, God, I'm not mad at you. I'm not pissed off. I'm just going to be one of these guys that's going to have to die drunk, and I'm okay with that, but please make it hurry. I felt just like Bill did on page 8 that I just read. Just in that morass of self-pity, that morass of self-involvement, that morass, you know? And that's how I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. Stinking, vibrating, shaking. Not a hope in the world. I don't know. There must have been a little angel with me that day. Because that Tuesday that I got my last desire chip was a long day. Long day. I'm 3 days after my last drink. I can barely walk. My brother drops me off at my place in Oak Cliff. He went through and we've got all the bottles that we could find and threw them away. And I'm supposed to go to our meeting that night. And I had another sponsor at the time. And he called me. He'd called me a couple times during the day. You going to make it tonight? I'm going to make it. Now, I'm not telling him that my brain is saying drink. I've got $22 to my name, I believe. 22, 23, something like that. All I had. And my brain is telling me to drink. And he calls me at 5 o'clock or 5:30 that day and says, look, my wife is giving birth. I'm not going to be there tonight, so you talk to Cliff. And I said, okay. Somehow I made it there. And I already told you, he gave me a hug, and we went to a little side room before the meeting started. And he sat me down before that meeting started, and he blew my mind on alcoholism. He disturbed me greatly about alcoholism. He gave me a good case of alcoholism. Why? Because he's recovered and been given the power to help me. He drank as much booze as I ever did. And I was the one dying, and he's not. He was free. You could see it in his little eyes, the little sparkle in his eye, the twinkle in his eye. This guy had the power. And he painted me into a corner. And then he asked me the question, are you a real alcoholic? And I'm crying and snotting all over myself. And I'm, yes, sir, I am. And he said, John Kelly, you're screwed. He used another word for screwed. I'll let you use your own imagination. And I'd thought that for years about my own situation. But for the first time in my life, that sunk home. I'm going to die drunk. He tells me that, and then he looks at me and he says, do you think it works for me? And I said, I know it works for you. And he says, well, how well is your way working? And I said, it's not. He says, what the hell do you have to lose except your life? And that's when he informed me that he was now my sponsor. And I was going to call him when he told me to call him. I was going to read what he told me to read. I was going to show up where he told me to show up. And we were going to take these steps the way it's outlined in this book, or else. And the or else for my sponsor is go away. Don't waste my time. That was my last entrance to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll finish up there next week, and I'll end here tonight. But all I did in that little meeting, that little brief meeting with that old man, is I took steps 1 and 2. I came to 2 conclusions. I'm screwed, and I hope. Welcome to steps 1 and 2. And I'll go into step 2 in more detail. That's it. I meet people all the time that are telling me, Well, I'm still working on step two. I've been working on step two for like a year. Well, what's there to work on? You hope it works or it don't, you know? I mean, you know, I mean, anyway, so it's very, very good to be here. I had a great time when I was here in the summer and I spoke. I don't know, I remember a lot of your faces, and I just want to thank you because, I mean, I love seeing all of your smiles. I mean, if any of you go to other groups, I mean, sometimes it's like speaking to a hostile environment, you know? And I love you people, and I've told everybody I can tell about, you know, if they're ever in Fort Worth, to come by here, because I was treated so nicely the last time I was here and so far tonight. So don't screw it up, okay? Thank you for having me.